You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Second City is back open for live shows, in-person classes, and customized corporate workshops and performances. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. You can go online and find out all the information you need at secondcity.com. So today's pod is with Sarah Stein Greenberg, who is the executive director of the D School at Stanford. And if you don't know about the D School, you're going to find out. Very cool place. She has written a new book. It's called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Enjoy the pod.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Sarah Stein Greenberg, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Kelly. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm glad we're starting the podcast after talking for about a half hour.
We just launched right into like the middle of our new friendship.
I really should have been recording. But we've had a ton of people from Stanford on the podcast. So people like Tina Seelig and Bob Sutton and Jennifer Ocker have all become friends. But what we haven't done is dig into the D School specifically and what makes that so special. And I think listeners of this podcast who've understood applied improvisation practices that we've talked about, there's a real kinship between what you refer to as assignments in the book and some of the practices that we offer in improv. So can you give us kind of like tell us a short bit about what is the D School and what makes it so special?
Yeah, great place to start. So the D School is this kind of unconventional institute in that we work with students and faculty from all across Stanford. And there are, I don't know, little known fact, well-known fact, there are seven different schools at Stanford. So we have med students working alongside engineers, working alongside public policy students, working alongside like English majors. And that mix of student perspectives means there's this like very potent blend of opportunity when it comes to creative work. And we'll take those teams of students coming from those different disciplinary backgrounds. And what they lack when they walk in the door at the D School is like a common way to navigate an open-ended problem. So we'll say, okay, work on this problem that's around designing some way to help parents of neonatal premature babies. Or we'll say, you know, work on this project around redesigning, you know, what kind of financial services should be available for people who've experienced a wildfire or some other kind of natural disaster. So, you know, projects that don't have right answers, lots of stakeholders involved. And it's the design process that we teach and the language that we give them that allows these students to connect from all of these different disciplinary perspectives. And when you get that really potent mix going, you have like just unbelievably creative solutions that come out of some of those classes and projects.
I love you refer to the D School. You say, quote, "We're hard on work, but soft on people, and we don't confuse kindness with weakness." Nice.
Yeah, there's a lot about being at the D School that like is centered around emotions and the way in which emotions are actually a really important part of creative work. And I think we don't shy away from that. In fact, I was lucky enough to be a grad student when the D School got started, and I took some of the very early classes. And at the time, there was actually a clinical psychologist who was on staff who actually like helped teams who were going through conflict really figure out how to navigate those difficult situations. Like creative work in a team brings up really, you know, real tensions, right? You're vulnerable. You have to trust people. So this idea of like, we want to critique the work, but we want to maintain the relationships within the team. And we want to keep, you know, maintain respect. And also we want to solve really hard problems. So how do you do all of that with the right spirit and the way that like keeps people open and keeps people offering their kind of unfinished ideas? And that idea of being hard on work, but soft on people, I think is really at the core of it.
Well, this feels like it's in a moment too. And I know this has happened at the D School for ages, but like with the extended mind and some other literature that's come out where people are talking about, you can't separate. We're going to have the feelings. We're always going to have the feelings. We're not just stoic Spocks with no. Yeah, I mean, so, but that is certainly not the way I was brought up, and I doubt you were too.
I mean, a lot of our students walk in the door and they're so focused on like solving the problem and finishing the project. And usually they're also handling, you know, a huge array of other responsibilities in their other classes and lives. And that's true for people who are, you know, at work in just kind of any organization you can imagine, especially in the moment that we're in, you know, we're really under a lot of pressure to perform and deliver. And one of the things that I think is really important, certainly that I've seen really change the trajectory for our students, is like you have to reset and understand that dealing with those team dynamics, it is part of the work. It is not getting in the way of the work to spend an hour to really say, you know what, I think we had a misunderstanding, right? I think we need to figure out a different way to navigate this. But I've seen students kind of suppress that because they think that is like, there's just no time to deal with that. And in fact, it has a huge impact on your outcomes. And one of the people that I quote in my book is Dan Klein, who teaches in the theater department at Stanford, and an incredible, incredible teacher of improv. And he really talks about how a lot of team conflict happens when one person is in an exploration mindset. The other person is in the like decision-making, or they're trying to narrow, or they're trying to get something done. And just being able to articulate. So it gets back to like, what's the common vocabulary that you have? Can you say to someone, oh, I really think we need to be expanding our options, expanding our solutions. And, you know, can we just hold off on making that decision for 15 more minutes and open up that space? Or someone else will say like, no, we've spent an hour on that, you know, exploration process. Let's try to move into a decision-making mode and then make a provisional decision and then get more data. So it's about having that way to you know, avert those, you know, deep misunderstandings where your feelings get really hurt just because somebody's in a completely different frame about where you are in the process.
I was just talking the other day to Francesca Gino, my buddy at Harvard. We're embedded in a class that she team teaches with Frances Fry, and both have been on the podcast, and Dan's been on too. But Frances was blown away by the simple idea in improvisation that we push over and over again, that you can't be creative and in judgment at the same time. You simply can't be. If you're judging, you're not being creative. And she was like, I don't know why I just didn't like that. Didn't dawn on me, but it's like so simple. But beginning improv is all about breaking down the ways we were either or taught to think or taught to feel or not think and really sort of like get out of that part of your brain, be playful. And it's not that we're not going to be judging later. I've often thought about this. I don't know that it's true, but I say it in my keynotes. I say that you can have creativity without innovation, but I don't think you can have innovation without creativity. That's probably
I think that's very wise. I think that's exactly right. And I, you know, that simple disarming idea about separating, distinguishing when you're in an idea generation mode and when you're in an idea selection or evaluation mode, it's really one of the most powerful tools, whether you're working by yourself or whether you're in a big group, you know, brainstorm activity at the moment. And I have to say, like, as a writer, I found that just that idea, I constantly have to remind myself to practice it, right? So it's like, I've been teaching at the D School for a long time, and I know in my bones that really, really helps teams move forward. But that internal censor, that internal critic, it creeps back in all the time because it is so much of how we're trained in most disciplines, in most parts of our education. And it's a constant practice to maintain, to separate those two different actions, the creative one and the evaluative one.
All right. You and I share something from childhood. Though mine was a crush. So I had a crush on Kathy Rigby after I saw her star in a live version of Peter Pan.
And it was,
I was obsessed by that, her and Peter Pan. I don't like, it was an early crush on a woman. Was it a woman playing man? We don't have to go into the psychology of that, but you start the book in the introduction, you say, quote, as a child, I was obsessed with Peter Pan.
I really was. I read the novel, I mean, at least once a year for many years when I was a kid. It actually kind of became a little bit of a tradition. And there was something that was so powerful to me about, I think, two things. One, just this idea of like a completely imaginary world where you just constructed all of the the lost boys and Peter and Wendy, like constructed their own rituals and their own mm-hmm. ways of being in there. And they went on adventures and there was sort of, you know, a little bit of danger and also like a lot of sort of reflection about the meaning of life, which I kind of figured out later mm-hmm. as I got older. But I do think the other special part was like, it was this totally liberating idea of like what kids can do left to their own devices and away from the world of adults. And I was a kid who just, I had a really active imagination. And there was something about that that spoke to me of like wanting to have that kind of agency and be able to create those worlds. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny to put out your sort of childhood obsession into the public domain. And I do think that you know, where your imagination is located as a kid, like we got to hold on to that in some way, you know, as we become adults. It's really important to continuing to act in a creative way and be a creative being.
So I started making this list. The book is a lot of assignments, and we were talking earlier, the great, incredible visuals and all that. It's not a traditional business book. And so, you know, I was trying to figure out the flow of our conversation. And I have a little section here called What's Standing in the Way. So this is what I came up with so far from reading the book. And I wonder if you can even add to it. So self-judgment is standing in the way, self-censoring, fear of failure, status or lack of it, systems that squash it, hierarchy, self-regulation. This is the all the baggage, right? Is there more? Like, but that feels like a pretty comprehensive list.
You know, I think one of those things that also gets in our way is routines. So some of the exercises in the book that I just find incredibly potent are the ones that are about retraining yourself to notice what's around you differently. So I'll give an example. There's a really powerful exercise in the book that Carissa Carter contributed. And actually it comes from, I think, the 60s and 70s in France. There was an art movement called the Situationists. It was kind of an art and political movement. And the idea behind the derive is that you drift on a walk, you drift around your city. And you do that by focusing first on one quality, like the color yellow or a smell or just smells in general, in fact. And then you find the next smell that catches your attention and you might document it. You might write about it in your notebook and then you move on. And so you're kind of creating this unexpected pathway that is created based on what you notice when you arrive at that next destination. It has a lot of, you know, sort of improvisational qualities about it. And what's incredible to me is when people come back from their derive, they report that they notice things that they have been walking by for 30 years that have been like hiding in plain sight. And only by having that attention and kind of refocusing on how they were going to navigate a situation, do they actually see what's right there. And that is when I think about great design work, it's often people say, you know, create something that in retrospect just feels so obvious, but it wasn't obvious to anyone else until someone noticed it in a different way. And I feel like that's one of, like, for me, routines are one of those things that just stops me from noticing things with that sort of childlike curiosity, with that open mind.
Yeah. And this is, if it can be called that, the gift of the pandemic, the gift of the social justice uprising, is forcing us to confront our systems, confront the things that we didn't see. So I'll give you an example from my world, which was at some point someone said, we're going back to Second City and we have all these, you know, art on the walls and photos for the cast and stuff. And someone's like, you got to do an art audit. And I'm like, what's that? And like, there, cause there's some objectionable images and I didn't know what they meant until I started looking. And there's an actor in dreads who's a white actor. And there's someone wearing, you know, Middle East, like a lot of Middle Easterns like stuff. And they're not Middle Eastern. And there's Hitler. Now, I recognize it's Dan Castellaneta, who's Homer Simpson, doing a satire on that. But there's no context for anyone else to see that. But I've worked at Second City for over 30 years. I can't see anymore. This is one of the things I loved about the book, which is like, it's almost like finding also ways to disrupt yourself, you know, and get you, so you can have your beginner eyes again. And that's possible. That's the thing that I think that a lot of people don't, they think, oh no, I'm stuck in tears. Like, no, you don't have to be. You're actually quite able to do this.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of us kind of try to think our way into new behaviors, but really what's at the heart of this book is all about like, how do you begin to act your way into those new behaviors and mindsets? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think one of those, you know, just talking about blocks, like you do have to start small. Like you don't, you know, start by like launching a whole big creative project. You start with a derive. You start by, you know, being more mindful with some of the mindfulness exercises. You start with the kind of warm-up that is about connecting with your team in a new way. And it just starts to unlock and unstick and unfreeze those old behaviors. And then you can build towards something that's even more radical. You know, the noticing example that you just gave of the artwork really makes me think about some of the research on stereotype threat, which is like, you know, one of the things that researchers have uncovered is that like, if you're a kid who is in a classroom, like if you're a female student and you're in a classroom and all the photos on the wall are of like famous male mathematicians or scientists, you just are much, you're actually less likely to perform to your potential on the exams that you take in that room, because you're absorbing this subtle message that you just don't actually have a place in that world. And so I do think that there's this incredible power in the context that's around us. And that's why like having those fresh eyes and looking in new ways, it helps you keep reinventing that to make sure that you're actually creating an inclusive environment for your whole community, that you're not unintentionally excluding various people just because of the, you know, history of where the organization has been. So I love that example that you gave. It's very, very powerful.
Well, I think that's where your choice architecture can come in terms of you have some ability to shift that. I mean, I've always been very aware from my experience in comedy and my wife's a comedy academic around status. It's hugely important. It's fundamental to like, especially all the old comedy duos, always high status, low status stuff. But you recognize too, like, you know, I'm going to carry status in a certain community in a really significant way, which means I have to work triple hard to make sure that someone is going to actually share with me, or, you know, make myself available to them in a way that I just assumed I was, and I wasn't necessarily. Okay. I want to talk about this great story that is at the beginning of the book. And it's about a handful of your students who met during a D-school class. And it did this rather extraordinary thing in India. And it starts, quote, like so many great tales, this story starts with a miscommunication, end quote. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So we had a team of students who were in a class called Design for Extreme Affordability. And all the partners that we have in that class who kind of tee up these opportunities for students to work on design projects with, they are working in low resource areas where, you know, cost is always a factor. And the students in this case were working in partnership with a hospital in southern India. The mission of this hospital is to provide very wide, like broad scale, but very low cost and high quality healthcare. That's like, those are three things that don't always go together.
Right.
And they, you know, in particular, the students were working at a hospital that provides cardiac surgery. So like really intensive, you know, like life altering medical interventions. And so the students went to visit and to do their initial research, and they showed up and the, you know, they met their partner, and the partner was like, oh, wait, we thought you were coming next week. Like, there had been a miscommunication about the timing. Mm-hmm. And so what happened for the students is, instead of having like the neatly laid out, you know, the interview schedule and everybody was all organized and ready to meet them, they were really told like, hey, you know, here's a hospital pass. Don't go into the emergency rooms or the operating rooms, but like anywhere else you can go and interact with people and engage. And they eventually, you know, worked with closely with a nurse who helped them interpret and really helped them connect with different patients. And that allowed them this opportunity to see this thing that was kind of hiding in plain sight. And what they noticed was there were a lot of people waiting. There were people in the waiting rooms, but there were also people in the hallways. They were kind of everywhere. And they also noticed that these people looked really stressed and anxious. And so instead of just sticking with what they thought their mandate was, which was like just to talk to clinicians or administrators or maybe patients, they started talking to these people who turned out to be the family members. Mm-hmm. And they found out, yes, these people are experiencing a lot of anxiety. They don't know what's going on. They don't know how to take care of their loved ones once they return home from the surgery. And the students felt they felt conflicted. So when they came back to Stanford and they started to interpret all of this data, on the one hand, they had this mandate around affordability and efficiency and trying to, you know, help with the patient flow. But on the other hand, they'd just heard these needs in a very powerful and very emotional way. And ultimately they decided, we want to design something that can support the experience of these family members. And they had a hunch that maybe there was some way that these family members could be equipped with some kind of education and skills to actually become part of the picture. So instead of being kind of excluded from the main event, which was the healthcare delivery, could they become part of that overall operation? So the students ultimately wound up founding this organization called Neura Health, which is doing incredible work and has been scaling really rapidly. They train family members with basic healthcare skills to be able to take care of their loved ones once they return home from a hospital stay. And with the cardiac example, the intervention has incredible efficacy. So they reduce rates of hospital readmissions, they reduce post-surgical complications, and they're really doing something that is very low cost and very, very inexpensive given the impact that it's having. So this all happened because the students showed up kind of prepared, but also with the ability to improv based on the conditions that they found. And part of their preparation was knowing you're going to see things that we, the teaching team, the faculty, we can't anticipate. We can't tell you to pay attention to them once you're in the situation. You have to start to cultivate judgment about what might be important. And that is exactly the kind of permission and the kind of skills that we're hoping to develop in our students, is that they take the agency, they take the role of actually naming what is the problem here to be solved. And that's what often opens up this very innovative space that no one else has noticed and nobody could exactly pinpoint before they went in to the situation and started using their design skills.
So this is a thing in design thinking, right? The idea of a problem statement?
Yes.
So talk to me a little bit about how do you construct a really good problem statement? And I'm secretly doing this because I've got a project at Second City that I want to have a problem statement for.
Okay, excellent. Well, yes, problem statement is it's like one of our many, you know, a little jargony. So let me break that down. So for the first thing to understand is like, we do think a lot about the balance between problem framing and problem solving. And most of the time people jump right into problem solving. And that is another one of those things to really be conscious of and to back off of. That's part of that deferring of judgment, right? If you know the solution at the beginning, it is very unlikely to be innovative. And it's just likely that you've kind of like gotten there because you're kind of amassing, you know, you're a little biased, you have some assumptions, et cetera. So first diving in to the process where you are exposing yourself to things that you couldn't know before you undertook the project. You're interviewing people, you're understanding their needs, you're sitting and observing the context that you're designing for an uncomfortably long period of time until you notice all the obvious stuff. And then the medium obvious stuff, and then the stuff that like really blows your mind because you've never thought about it before in that space. And then what you have is this pile of very messy subjective data, right? You've got some interviews, you've got some quotes, you've got some things that really stood out. You took some pictures. What do you do with all that data? Well, your goal is to come to what we call a point of view or a problem statement. And that's where you frame up, here's the problem that I really want to try to work on and address. And we often talk about that as having a couple of components. It's really clear about who you're designing for. So you're not just trying to kind of generically make things better for everyone. You name who is the person that you are designing for. Maybe that's an individual or a type of person. You name what their need is. And what's really important about that is you name the need, not the solution. So in the case of these students working with these family members, the family members need a way to be informed. They need a way to be involved. They need a way to lower their anxiety. That doesn't actually presuppose what the form or even the nature of the solution is. And oftentimes, the first time somebody writes a problem statement, they put the solution right in there.
Yeah.
And you can tell because it's often a noun instead of a verb. So that's like just the really shortcut way to make sure you're talking about the need and not the solution. It's like they need a way to blank, not they need a thing. And then the third piece is like, you've got some insights. You notice something that feels important, but you don't quite know how it is connected. And you want to lump that in there too. So a good problem statement doesn't have to be the most beautiful wordsmith thing, but it's this combination of user and need and insight. And that allows you to kind of frame up this new space that you're going to try to direct your creative attentions to.
That's perfect. And I didn't have to charge for that. So that's, you can charge
that's
me
a freebie. That's a total freebie.
Something we talk about on the podcast a lot, and I love that it showed up in this book, which you say, quote, "You need to rid yourself of the myth that creative genius is a solo act of conjuring original thought from thin air. It really doesn't work that way." And it is such a myth, especially in where you live, right? I mean, this is like a Silicon Valley thing. It's like, somehow Steve Jobs just did all of this on his own. There was no one else involved at all. And it's like, that is so far from true. But it is ingrained in the sort of American myth. It's always like, it's the great man theory, right? And it really is destructive. And we know this from our work because it's like, we have a phrase in our work that all of us are better than one of us, because that's just essentially true in practice and experience. So talk to us a bit about that sort of group creativity and collaboration.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it as like, it's what's happening between people. That's really where a lot of the important work gets done. Now, important work gets done on the individual level. And like everyone's been on a team where somebody's not pulling their weight and that feels really crappy. But the real idea is like contribute what you can contribute as an individual and show up for to help make everyone better. I mean, and that is right out of improv, right? Like make your partner look good is the key. And I think it's quite interesting because that requires a little bit of a posture of generosity. You do have to tackle and kind of confront that hero's myth, right? That idea that like, if you say your idea louder or better, like somehow that's how you get the status in your group. Particularly for people who walk in with higher status, maybe men, maybe people who are white, maybe people who are from the US, if you're working in an international group, depends on the context, who has higher status. Like you have to really work to make sure that you're not actually taking up all the space where other people's ideas could contribute, especially if you're on like an interdisciplinary and diverse team. So if you can adopt that posture of like making your partner look good, making your team members look good, it is unbelievable where you can get to versus if you try to kind of hoard that time and space for yourself. But you do have to figure out then in your team, what's the new way that you're assigning status? How do you celebrate a team win, right? Versus just an individual win. How do you celebrate and identify all those individual contributions? And I think there are different ways that you can do that. And one way is like, think about team rituals as a place for your creativity. Right? Like for your particular team, what can you do to actually create that celebration ritual or to balance those status and hierarchy that you're walking in with so you get the right results?
One of the things too I love about this book is the attempts to sort of just like simplify everything. And you write in the book, quote, "There's nothing revelatory about design. It's very intuitive. There are people, they have needs. We make guesses. We build something for them. We put it back in their hands. We learn from that and we iterate." Beautiful. I just had Gary Bowles on the podcast, who has a great book called The Next Rules of Work. And he has a thing where he says, quote, human work is just three things: our human skills to perform tasks, to solve problems. I have yet to like strike that down. And it's, and I think you're both getting at the same thing, which is like, we've got people and we've got problems. And yeah. So we need to understand people and then the best way to solve our problems.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I really do think that it is that simple in some ways. And of course, it's also way more complex.
Yeah,
sure. That quote in my book comes from actually a designer who really mentored me when I was just starting out. Her name is Nicole Kahn. And mm-hmm. she is, you know, just an incredible designer, long career at IDEO. She now is at WeWork. And she just has a way of like cutting through all of the jargon. And it is that simple. And I think that's very freeing. I think, you know, the idea of design or creativity, it does have a lot of baggage. I mean, it's related to that myth we were just talking about. And a lot of people just flat out think they are not creative. Right. And that is really unfortunate because as human beings, we are creative. We are naturally problem solvers. But you do have to like figure out how you can like step through these kinds of challenges and kind of what's your own process? What's your way of approaching these problems? And part of the reason I think that's so important right now is because like every single one of us is faced with a range of problems that we have not been really trained for our communities have not addressed before, our country has not solved.
Yeah.
And there aren't obvious solutions. If there were obvious solutions, we wouldn't be having the kinds of challenges that we do. And so having a way to know that you can step into an open-ended, messy problem like this, that this is the time. Like we need everyone to actually claim that creative agency because we need creative thinking. We need people to solve these problems in new ways.
Can we talk about a couple assignments?
Please.
All right. I want you to talk to us about what's in your fridge.
Okay. Well, what's in your fridge is a brilliant little assignment created by a woman named Leah Siebert. And she was running a project with a group of people who are focused on obesity and designing solutions around reducing obesity. And she was trying to think about like, well, I've got a whole group of stakeholders from all across the map to bring together. What is a way that we can launch this project in a meaningful and human way? And so she had everybody bring in a photograph of the inside of their fridge, which sounds pretty weird. Mm-hmm. Like, I think even I, like in thinking about it, I'd be like, oh, do I clean that fridge before I take that picture? Like, am I going to manicure this a little bit? But it's amazing what you can see mm-hmm. when you compare, like, so two people will come together and compare their photos. And it provides this rich opportunity to ask for unexpected stories. And like food and behaviors around food are so related to family and culture and time pressure and, you know, those inherited recipes. And like, you could see how it could go in so many different directions.
Right.
And there's also something very cool about it being visual, because then it puts some of that power to like direct the conversation in the hands of the person who's asking the questions. And anyway, it's a really amazing way to launch a kind of project. And you could imagine like if you're working on a medical topic, you could have everybody bring in a photo of their medicine cabinet.
Yeah.
Or, you know, an athletic project, like what's the inside of your, you know, like what, show us where you put your sneakers, right? Like in mm-hmm. your house. Mm-hmm. And it's about breaking down that idea that like those are details that are somehow like too personal to be shared on a first. It just cuts out all the small talk, right? So I think that it's a powerful way to launch into a much more productive creative collaboration where you're going to have to trust each other. You're going to share unfinished ideas. You're going to get feedback. Yeah. And like, do you have some kind of bond there that can help support that?
And there's vulnerability in, you know, in opening up that space. It made me think of a few shows ago, actually many shows ago, a few years ago, we had a little improv segment inside one of the reviews where two of the actresses went in the audience, asked someone to unlock their iPhone and hand it to them. And they each did. And then they just went through and started looking at stuff and talking about it. And it was like, and it was very dangerous in one regard, because like, what's going to show up? But you know, we're going to protect people. And it actually ended up being really wonderful in terms of a glimpse into someone's weird world with the last person they texted or what was latest on their Instagram and that sort of thing. So
yeah, I can't believe that happened like live in a, yes. Those are like good improv audience members. Like that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
We actually do a similar activity that a couple of folks created that is about helping you get your head around when you are the designer and you might be going and interviewing someone, mm-hmm. you're actually really asking to kind of like rummage around in their life and in their brain. Yeah. And so to prepare students to be thinking about some of the ethical issues that come up around that, we do an exercise where we ask them to unlock their phones and hand it to another person. Mm-hmm. And then you, for an uncomfortably long period of time, you do that rummaging around process mm-hmm. in someone's phone. And it's very interesting because like some people sort of like hold it like at arm's length and, yes. you know, like as if it's, you know, a totally foreign object. And some people just like get right into, you know, scrolling and getting into the photos and getting into the contacts. I mean, it's very interesting. It reveals something about your disposition in terms of how you think about handling someone else's data and stories and experiences. And that is a part of design work that's also important. It's like, are you actually, you know, so it's like when you're going and observing and finding other people's needs, are you doing that on their behalf or on your behalf? Are you thinking about what that interaction is really all about? Are there some power dynamics you need to really explore when you're doing that? So it's very cool to hear about that completely different usage of a mm-hmm. very similar technique.
Yeah. Tell us about the story of your name.
The story of your name is one of my personal favorite ways to get a group going. I like to do it in pairs. And the way it works is that I'll have people pair up and the prompt is tell each other the story of your name. And what's cool about that is it's a little rough around the edges, right? So people can say like, oh, I got my name from my grandmother, or, you know, everyone always mispronounces my name, or I changed my name. Like there's so many different ways that people can take that prompt. And it's like a small amount of disclosure. Yeah. But you can also control what that story is, right? So mm-hmm. like, you know, you have multiple stories about your name. You can decide which one you're going to reveal. Then I like to take that small bond that's happened between the pair and then pair that group up with another pair and do another exercise in that same sequence. And so I'm actually using it as, you know, we were talking about kind of like, how do you start to unlock these new behaviors? Mm-hmm. Like, I do think it's really tough sometimes when you're in a big group and you just start with like a big extroverted kind of icebreaker. And yeah. that does leave some people behind, right? That is yeah. profoundly uncomfortable for a lot of people. If you're like, we're playing sound ball, we're playing, you know, just like mm-hmm. we're shouting out a word, particularly if you have a group of people who don't also have the same primary language. Yeah. So I've really tried to work on how do you stage those kinds of experiences? Because your end goal is the same. It's that trust and vulnerability and openness in collaboration, but you will have to meet people where they are. So I love the kind of the pair and then the quad, and then you kind of build on that and ask increasingly personal questions and see what comes out.
Yeah. For beginning improv classes, it's not unusual for us in silence to have people just walk the space and notice things. And that's power, you know, the assignments in the book that are like that. Okay, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story after one more exercise. How are you doing really?
Well, how are you doing really is an incredible exercise that was created by actually that clinical psychologist who I mentioned. And it really is about trying to get at that not superficial layer of like what people are walking into the room with. You know, so you walk into a class, you walk into work, you walk into, you know, a conference, whatever it is. And when people ask how you're doing, you're like, I'm great. Or maybe during the pandemic, you're like, I'm great. Like, right. but that just doesn't actually afford you the chance to kind of either kind of check what's going on with you and leave it at the door, or make a connection that feels more authentic. And so how are you doing really? You take, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, you write on post-its how you are really doing. I'm stressed. I didn't have time to eat breakfast. I'm worried about my mom. I'm actually really affected today by what's going on politically, but whatever it, you know, or I'm really happy. I just had a big success at work, you know, whatever it is. You put those post-its on your body and you walk around and you find someone else. Then you're able to have, it's, you know, it feels a little silly, right? You're covered in post-its, but you're able to have a connection with someone where they've externalized some of their interior monologues, some of their interior feelings. And again, everybody has their control to say how much, you know, or how little about those different stories as they want to. But it's a way to bring more of that authentic feeling into the room.
That made me think Heidi Brooks at Yale has a thing that she does when she has a new cohort, which is everyone anonymously on a piece of paper writes down a pain they have. And then she just reads them one after mm-hmm. one. And that was always very moving to me because and we've talked a lot about this in this podcast, that people don't share the incredible pain they're in. And when you are someone who has faced a tragedy or whatever, you find that out because people then start sharing. And it's just, it's so wrong in terms of our culture and the kind of silent suffering that exists. And what I love about our work, what I love about your work is it's really trying to promote, no, we can say the hard things. And if we can say the hard things, we can do the hard things. And our work is very playful and joyous, but it's pretty serious too. I mean, right?
I think that's right. I mean, we're really seeing that right now as we transition. We're moving back into in-person on-campus classes right now. And, you know, faculty and students, we are all having a wide range of emotions as a result of that. And, you know, there are interactions with students who are like so joyful and so grateful and so excited to be there in person and are yeah, actually expressing more gratitude than like we've ever heard from students before about the courses. And then there are other students who are like, last year sucked. I'm behind. I'm feeling really crap. You know, like I now have all these competing things that I didn't realize the pace of the work. And those are some pretty negative emotions to deal with. And they're all happening together. Mm-hmm. So I do think, especially at a moment like this, you got to find a way to bring that into the room. You can't ignore it because it is in the room. It is in the work. It is in the creative process. And either you acknowledge it and you deal with it and you meet people where they are, or it seeps in somehow. And so I really like your phrase about silent suffering. I mean, I don't like that it needs to be named, but like that is real. That is real. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just incredibly important in creative work and frankly, any kind of work to actually acknowledge what's really going on with people.
We end the podcast. We always ask our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when two people are working without a script, they're going to get nowhere if they say no. And they actually don't get that far by saying yes. They have to say yes and. So I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
I do have a yes and story. The first thing that comes to mind is that I when I graduated from college, I was in like an unusually risk-taking mode. Like I'm kind of a planned out person. But at that moment, I was like, I know I want to move to New York, but I don't have a job and I don't have a place to live. And I got in touch with my friend, Jenny, and she was like, oh, well, actually, I've been thinking about moving out of my apartment and you could have the space. And I said, yes. And then she said, and but, you know, it's like, as you might remember, I have a roommate. And I was like, oh, that's right. It's a studio apartment. And it's like really, really tiny. And also we have bunk beds. And I was just like, yes, I will absolutely take that space. And it just turned out to be the most incredible first year of, you know, being post-college, moving to New York, living in the Lower East Side. My roommate actually is an actor and was active at UCB at the time in New York. And it was just the most incredible sort of, it sounds so funny in retrospect that like, I slept in a bunk bed as an adult in New York, you know, but that was, it was just, and it was this wonderful sequence of just saying like, yeah, I'll try it out. Like what could go wrong? Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing that comes to mind when I think about that yes and question.
I love it. That's great. The book is called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Sarah Stein Greenberg, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by The Second City, Second City Works, and WGN Radio. It's also produced by Elif Garris, with help by Mike Farinacchio and Colleen Fahey. The music that you hear that intros and outros the program is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you want to get more information on The Second City, you can reach us at www.secondcityworks.com or email us at works@secondcity.com. Screaming at the top of their lungs.
survived 10 million feet.
Survive.